Yes.
May we ask the court's permission to have them sit?
Sure. Absolutely.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Garmerian is with me, I believe, Mr. Anderson.
That way they can pass notes to you as you're messing up. That's the way it usually works.
Your Honor, may it please the court, Ms. Allen is here this morning.
You're gonna, before we get started, you're gonna reserve any time for rebuttal?
I beg your pardon, I've asked for 2 minutes, Your Honor.
Yes, sir.
Here this morning asking that this court find that the Alexandria Circuit Court was in error in overruling Mr. Allen's plea and bar and did not dismiss the suit for divorce that Mr. Allen filed. And I have a real concern that, like many attorneys, I'm gonna make this more complicated than it really needs to be. So if I may, I'd like to refer to the contract at issue.
Let me help you a little bit, and we all spent a lot of time on this case. It's a very interesting case from a lot of perspectives, and I did a little bit of additional research, and it appears that the majority rule as it exists in the United States is that parties can actually contract to divorce. They can do that. The antithesis is not true. You can't contract to to forbear in a divorce, but you can't really contract to divorce. And there's a public policy associated with that, and it's a very good and strong public policy. But as I said, the majority rule appears to be that parties can actually contract to forbear for a divorce, particularly when consideration is given back and forth. That seems to be the majority rule. And Virginia, as best I can tell, is either following or is very close to the majority rule when it comes to that. Having said that, why shouldn't we as a court simply look at this from a straight contract determination, evaluate the consideration that both parties gave in the matter, and decide the case based upon that?
Well, I think that I agree that you don't necessarily need to reach the issue of can parties contract to forbear divorce, because I think the Upton case is very clear in Virginia that you can do that.
Yeah, it's very close to absolute statement on that. Or fraudulent or coercive, yeah.
So I think that question has already been answered. And if that's the case, then I agree with you that you look to the plain language of the contract, which you do today de novo. You look at the trial court's decision on this issue de novo because it's a question of interpretation. And you look at the language of the contract to figure out what the parties really mean. And what this contract is a post-nuptial agreement. They could have called it the marital settlement agreement. Mm-hmm. They could have called it a property settlement agreement. They chose to call it a postnuptial agreement.
The question that I kept asking myself as I was going through this case, and my law clerks enjoyed it because I was poking my head in their offices all the time discussing this because it was so very interesting, and the question I kept asking myself is, what does Ms. Allen really want here? Does she want to force this man to stay married to her, or does she really want to protect what she needs, that is the medical insurance, the health insurance that is going to basically take her for the rest of her life, and concerned about losing that, and also concerned about essentially contracting away her opportunity to participate and get money out of the 401k, which is another issue that we're going to set aside. What is your client's real goal here?
She wants to stay married.
Okay.
She wants Mr. Allen to be held to the contract that he agreed to sign.
Well, isn't there a provision in that contract then for damages, as opposed to, you're asking for specific performance, which is discretionary with the court, and there's also a provision for damages in terms of monetary damages.
I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think we have to step back and look at the time of contracting, what were they trying to do? In the first instance, you have a provision that says, husband shall not pursue a dissolution of the marriage for a period of 20 years. Now, you could maybe write that more elegantly, but you could not write that more clearly. You could read that to a fourth grader and ask the fourth grader, what does that mean? And the fourth grader would say, well, that means he's not going to sue for divorce, period. That's the end of that story. And the question would then be, well, is that what they really meant? And the record is clear that that's what they really meant. When they said, husband shall not pursue a dissolution of the marriage for a period of 20 years, in the record are letters from the husband that says, this is from the husband's counsel, Husband will give up his right to obtain a divorce, and he shall not file for divorce for 20 years.
But you don't even really get to look at that, though, do you? If you're just looking at a contract, if you're looking for contractual interpretation?
I think that's correct. I think you can rely on the plain language of this contract. Now, what the appellee argues is that if you look at the contract as a whole, that there is some sort of damages provision. We disagree with that, because you look at what they were trying to do. Now, there are a couple different things at play here. At first, yes, we want to preserve her health insurance. This is health insurance that is only available to her as a spouse of an employee of Caterpillar. So how do we make sure that she still has access to that particular plan? Well, the first thing we have to do is to make sure that she stays his spouse.
So or isn't there another way if there is available to her comparable health insurance that's going to leave her in the same position that she would have otherwise been if he had forbore divorce? Doesn't that answer the question?
You are asking a hypothetical, because that is nowhere in the record. There is no proof in the record. There is no plan document. There is no statement or summary of different provisions that shows that there is a comparable plan. This court made a decision, or the trial court made a decision, based on the contract, not based on an evaluation of other available insurance policies. But even if it were to do that, there are benefits to remaining married beyond just the health insurance. And again, who are these parties? This woman is in her 50s. She is extremely ill. She has a debilitating illness. She's in a wheelchair. They've got her on methadone. It is falling apart.
Yeah, I understand that, but I think that the bigger question is, and my concern, because this is just the way I am, is to make sure that this woman is cared for. You know, the bottom line is he's got an obligation to her. He married her. She became sick. He's got a moral and a legal obligation coming from the contract. But what if we had a situation, and this may well be the case, where the husband lost his job at Caterpillar? And he say he's done everything right. He didn't do anything wrong. Caterpillar says, we're cutting back, you lose your job. And he says, look, I've got this obligation to my wife. She's sick. I'm not gonna just leave her hanging out dry here. And he goes around and he finds insurance that's going to keep her in the same position. The insurance company's going to ignore the pre-existing condition. They're going to allow him to let her have this insurance, and he's gotta pay a premium for it, okay? Why isn't that, under your analysis, a bad thing?
There's a couple different pieces of that hypothetical that I would want to address, but I think I can use a simple hypothetical in answering. Let's assume that I sign a contract with my wife that says, I am going to have the vase that has been sitting in the living room for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And she goes to Marshall's and she buys an identical vase. It's the same exact thing, mm-hmm, in every regard. And she comes to me and she gives it to me, and I look at the bottom of it and I see the price tag, and I say, well, wait a minute, that's not the vase I want. I want that vase. And she says, but it's the same thing. I'm giving you the exact same thing. And I said, no, that is not what I contracted for. I wanted that vase.
I understand your argument on that and why specific performance would be what you prefer, but the agreement talks about if that doesn't happen. First, it talks about if there's a breach with regard if someone does sue for divorce. And then under paragraph 7, under health insurance, it talks about if loss of insurance is due to husband's actions, as Judge Alston was just referring, he shall be responsible for paying the cost of comparable health insurance, where there's no pre-existing condition, presumably even if he has to get it from Lloyd's of London. Mm-hmm. And it's an astronomical price. Why then, if the agreement contemplates those aspects, why is specific performance the only possibility here?
But does the court get to make that decision? If the parties sign a contract that says the husband is not going to pursue a divorce for 20 years, and if he does anything to, you know, mess up the health insurance, he's going to have to provide her comparable insurance. Why does the court get to say, well, you know what? This comparable plan is just as good. That's what they meant. We're going to let you go ahead and do that. I don't think the court has the authority to do that when two parties amongst themselves have made a decision, for whatever reason, that this is the way they're going to structure their agreement. Now, if you look at it from Ms. Allen's perspective, maybe there are other reasons why she wants to stay married. We may not know what they are. They could be social reasons. You know, she Caterpillar is a huge institution up in Peoria, Illinois, where she lives now. It's, you know, it's like Bethlehem Steel was back in the day. Mm-hmm. This is a lifestyle. And maybe it was important to her to remain part of the Caterpillar.
Well, can I ask you on that then? How do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that once the trial court entered the order that it did, no motion for sort of a stay or anything was entered to try to preserve, because then husband goes ahead and does other things?
Well, in the first instance, the court is not to, my opinion, the court is not to consider actions that occurred after the record was closed in this manner. I don't think that Mrs. Allen is required to file. All she's required to do is properly name her appeal. And if as
so a what date do you see the record as ending? October 26th, or what date? Because I was looking at the order. So obviously, the order of the court, circuit court, you think is in the record, right?
I think it depends on how you define the record. But the record would close certainly as of the date the final order was entered. And if there was no further, you know, motion to reconsider, I think the record closes 21 days after the court enters its final.
And there was no motion to reconsider.
And there was no motion to reconsider. That's correct. So, again, I mean, judging from the court's questions, I feel that there is an aspect to this where you worry about, well, you know, should we really hold somebody to a marriage, as Mr. Allen argues, that he really doesn't want to be in? And the answer to that is certainly we do. You certainly knew, the evidence is clear in the record, that he knew precisely what he was doing at the time he entered this contract. They not only entered a contract once, they entered a memorandum of understanding several months prior. So he did it twice. And it was his idea that they stay married. So if we're going to pick a case where the court is going to invade the party's judgment.
Because she had actually earlier filed for divorce, right?
She had. And so the valid question is, well, why was he so anxious to make sure that that case went?
But the thing about it is she didn't contract that away. She had the ability to file, correct?
She had the ability to file.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Now, again, there's probably a reason that they did that. And again, for the court to say that a comparable policy is just as good ignores what these two people did in this contract. She didn't want that policy. She wanted this policy.
But the thing about it is the thing that I get going back to, and I appreciate you trying to answer my question, but if we have a situation where there's impossibility of performance, such as he loses his job at Caterpillar through no fault of his own, and so it's impossible that he's going to be able to maintain that health insurance policy that he had before, what remedy is available to you?
Now, that remedy is dealt with in the contract.
Okay.
That is dealt with in the contract. What the contract says is, if loss of insurance is due to the husband's actions, he shall be responsible for paying the cost of comparable health insurance. And if comparable health insurance coverage is not available, he shall indemnify and hold the wife harmless. But it also says...
I remember now. There's a provision in there that says he can go out, if it's through no fault of his own,
exactly.
He can go out and get comparable. I remember that now. Yeah.
They covered that, possibly. So all of the way the contract is structured, again, part of the reason they have to remain married for the health insurance is because it's granted to them as a condition of her being a spouse of an employee. I see that my time...
One other question. I'll stop your time at this point, but I want you to think about this, or you can answer now. What remedy are you suggesting here?
I am suggesting that the court enter an order vacating the final order of divorce, remanding this matter to the trial court for an award of fees incurred on appeal at the trial court level. And I believe the court has the authority under the Virginia Code to enter an order that neither party is entitled to a divorce. So you would actually allow that action to have a final order. You would remand it. We would ask you to remand it, award fees, and then enter an order that neither party is entitled to.
I thought that might be what you're asking. Again, I'm not holding this against your time, but I always like to look at the implications of what we do in a situation like this. And this didn't happen here, and I know it's a hypothetical question, but I want to say you deal with it because you're a very good lawyer. What if during this time that has existed between entry of the final order by the trial court and now, husband had remarried? What would be the status of that marriage if we were to, in a sense, vacate the divorce? Is that a void marriage, avoidable marriage?
It's a void marriage.
Okay.
A marriage
Okay.
So if he was married at the time, he's not permitted to be remarried. So it would be considered void.
Okay. Very good. Yes, sir. I know you're sitting there chomping at the bit, y'all, exchanging notes with, I'd love to see those notes.
Well, Your Honor, the court has certainly framed the issue properly, and I believe that the trial court also framed the issue the same as to whether or not specific performance is appropriate here, and whether or not there was an adequate remedy of law, such as specific performance would not be appropriate. And the trial court found, based on the contract itself, any evidence that was presented at that hearing, that in fact there was an adequate remedy at law. And that not only is there an adequate remedy, which is health insurance, but that it was in fact contemplated, negotiated, and anticipated by the parties.
Do you agree with your opponent, colleague, that the majority rule and in what appears to be the rule in Virginia is that parties can contract to forbear divorce?
Well, Your Honor, we disagree with the application of the Upton case. The Upton case does not involve the forbearance or the inability to file for divorce for a certain period of time. Upton stands for the proposition only that you can waive your right for grounds for divorce. And we see this waiver for grounds of divorce in numerous separation agreements in the Commonwealth every day. There'll be a provision there that says the parties agree that either party may file for divorce, and it will be done based on no-fault grounds. That is a well-established principle that is based on Upton. Nowhere in the Commonwealth, not Burke and not Upton or any other case that we've ever been able to find, I don't think the Commonwealth, Your Honor, but we'd be curious to see some cases where these continuation of marriages clauses have been upheld anywhere else, because we've had it for a difficult time. This seems to me a situation where we're not seeing a 20-year forbearance ever being upheld. And again, if I'm out of line, we certainly didn't find it.
I guess we could get into a discussion as to, you know, the duration of this particular agreement. We could talk about that, but as I said, pretty much every case I read, I think the only exception was Tennessee, which talked about that parties could indeed forbear divorce. And the consideration that was provided in all of the cases that I saw was similar to the consideration here, you know, forbearance from a 401k plan, keeping people off your spouse's benefit, keeping insurance in place. There was always some exchange which the court kind of latched on from a consideration standpoint.
Well, Your Honor, in the Commonwealth, we don't believe that Upton would apply. Upton, again, is very clear. In Upton, the parties did get a divorce. All that the husband did was waive his right to bring grounds in a cross bill for, I believe it was desertion, or I don't have it in front of me. But that is certainly not analogous in any way, shape, or form to agreeing to forbear being a divorce for 20 years based on no fault. We haven't seen that in any agreement, and there is no case law in the Commonwealth that's ever upheld any time base that goes beyond a no-fault 1 year. Grounds, we accept, and again, we see in contracts every day, and that is a well-established principle. What the appellant is asking for in Virginia has never, ever been that happened. In fact, the Burke case, which is cited to, is the waiver of a right to appellate review. We have never seen a case that has caused one party to stay married against their will.
Can you state, because the decision that you're asking us to make is essentially going to have to be one based upon some interpretation of policy. Can you tell us some of the policy considerations that you would suggest to us would support your view of the case?
Well, yes, Your Honor. As has been stated in the recent Supreme Court case of Obergefell versus Hodges, you know, as they put it, no union is more profound than marriage. Marriage embodies the highest ideal of love, fidelity, devotion, sacrifice, and family. And Your Honor, we would say that in this case, if we accept the appellant's view, Mr. Allen would not be allowed to pursue a divorce no matter what happened, no matter what Miss Allen did. She could defame him, and in fact, he could never take any action to divorce her. She could assault him, wound him, and in fact, he would still be forced to stay married to this woman. She could take action to destroy his reputation. She could make him repugnant or revolted to be associated with any way, shape, or form. And for 20 years, he would have to be in a relationship which has been described by the United States Supreme Court as the most profound union that there is. Marriage is a voluntary union, and the continuation of it is the voluntary union. And it is the most personal contract that two parties can enter into. And the times of Upton and things have changed. That it is now viewed as the most solemn union. And to order a man to stay married, to stay in what is considered the most solemn, the most profound, the highest form of personal contract, goes against specific performance law. And, Your Honor, I just wanted to get back to my point that in the continuation of marriage clause, it says husband shall not pursue a dissolution of the marriage for a period of 20 years or obtain a judicial decree that results in the right to disqualification of health insurance coverage. But it says right after that sentence, which has been left out in the appellant's brief and an argument, it says if husband takes any actions, and any actions, that result in wife being disqualified from said health insurance coverage, he shall indemnify and hold the wife harmless from any expenses for medical treatment that would have otherwise been covered by said health insurance. That covers it, and that was Mr. Allen's rationale for entering into this. Your Honor, the record is clear that there's a letter, the last page, the last appendix, a letter from Mr. Allen's counsel to Mrs. Allen's counsel. And it's the very last page, page 414. It says, request for continuance. It says that Mr. Allen has generally tried to find a way for Mrs. Allen to have full health care coverage.
Where are you reading from now?
I'm reading from the letter.
I know, but what page of the letter? On the appendix. 413, 414. 414, okay.
Yeah, Mr. Allen has generally tried to find a way for Mrs. Allen to have full health care coverage under the Cadillac policy and be secure in her life, while at the same time accepting profound limits to his future life. He's concerned that his offer would seriously considered by Mrs. Allen. Mr. Allen was concerned about health insurance only. He believed that this language had indicated that he, if a husband takes any action that results in wife's disqualification, would allow for him, if as long as he provided this health care coverage. And Your Honor, this remedy, or liquidated damages, as we call it, but it's purely remedy, is then reiterated again in paragraph 7. Of the same agreement, which covers health insurance. And
how
again,
do you answer your opposing counsel's argument to the question I asked him earlier, that that was the breach and this is the remedy? And he says, no, it's not, because the promise to not divorce for 20 years trumps this on specific performance. This is if he loses his job or something else.
Well, Your Honor, that was actually covered during the hearing, and Judge Clark and the circuit court asked counsel, well, doesn't it say any action? And counsel was saying, how do you know that meant other things or everything? And counsel on the record indicated, we don't know. We don't know. What we know is that the language itself, which simply says if husband takes any actions, right after that language, it says if husband takes any action, not if the husband takes other actions or additional actions.
So basically, you're conceding that your client is in breach.
Well, Your Honor, as it stands right now, our argument is that there is a remedy built into, contemplated by these parties.
But a remedy assumes liability.
Well, it assumes that the health care coverage, if this were to happen, and as the court has pointed out, if you were to lose a job, I can tell you, and I believe that the door has been opened to some discussion as to what's taken place since, because of the failure to file a stay in this matter, that by counsel not filing the motion to stay, Mr. Allen was free to remarry. He looked upon that date, that deadline, as a trigger point. Are they going to appeal? You have to file this motion to stay so that I can't. He brought this because he has fallen in love with another person and he wanted to marry. He has remarried. And that marriage, when he married her, was legal. There was no stay in place. The appellant didn't file the appropriate documents to stop him legally from doing so, and he went about his legal right to marry the person he actually loves and wants to be with. And he is now legally married to her, under no stay to stop that. So we don't agree that we believe that Mrs. Allen has slumbered on her right to stop.
Can I ask you on that? I mean, if we're going to talk outside the record, if that is outside the record, didn't Mr. Allen get married before it was outside of the trial court's jurisdiction, where it was within a time that a motion for reconsideration could be filed, or am I misremembering the date in your brief?
No, he got married after the final decree had been signed, and after the deadline.
After the 21 days had expired?
Well, no, after the date for a motion to stay should have been filed, and that was what everybody was looking for as the sign that you obviously were going to appeal and you can't get remarried. I mean, he made it known that he wanted to be married. That was the purpose for bringing this divorce in the first place. Was that he had fallen in love with a woman that lives with her? These parties were separated at the time of the signing of this agreement. There was no continuation of a relationship. They were separated. Mr. Allen, she had filed for divorce and they had been separated. They've been continuously separated throughout. They never lived together. They are strangers now. And Mr. Allen simply wanted to move on with his life and enter into what is this solemn, this highest form of union with another woman.
But your opponent colleague would suggest to us that he contracted away the ability to move along with his life.
Well, Your Honor, we believe it was the trial court's discretion to decide whether or not to force specific performance and forcing to stay married for 20 years, or to find an adequate remedy of law. And the trial court found an adequate remedy of law based on a full record, a complete record that was set forth, and decided based on that there is a separability clause with paragraph 13 of the party's continuation of marriage, that their agreement. Paragraph 13 allows for the remaining provisions to be in full force and effect. Any provision is held to be invalid or unenforceable.
Speak to us a little bit about this use of this parole evidence. I sort of jumped out at me a little bit too. Explanations to what these contractual terms meant. What's your view on that?
Well, Your Honor, we did object during the hearing, during the plea bar. We objected to the use of any parole evidence. We thought that we should only look at the contract. It was the appellant who brought in former counsel to testify, brought in letters between counsel. We objected that they were the product of settlement. And I think the trial judge wanted a full record before him to decide this matter. It was important to him. He looked at letters. He heard testimony from a prior counsel. He looked at everything to decide whether or not that this remedy of law that's included in not only the continuation of marriage section right afterward, but then again in paragraph 7, which was the crux of this entire thing, was that Mrs. Allen would be cared for. She is being cared for under a plan. But Mr. Allen is no longer with Caterpillar. This is an impossibility at this point. He is no longer employed at Caterpillar. He is retired, and the health insurance coverage that he's providing to us is through his retirement, but will end soon, and he's going to have to trigger this remedy of law. This remedy is going to happen, whatever the case, and nothing will change by invalidating, by dismissing the divorce, making them married again, invalidating the legal marriage. Nothing will change for Mrs. Allen. She is not going to get the coverage that she had. He is not eligible in this retirement that he took for health insurance. He has none through Caterpillar. He pays for her COBRA, and then his plan is to pay for her to find the very best health insurance out there. So we are looking at an actual impossibility. There is no benefit to Mrs. Allen.
How about the 401k that apparently there was some forbearance in collecting from? What about that?
Well, Your Honor, that has nothing to do, nor has it been brief, anything to do with this forbearance of marriage or this thing. The reason for the 20-year agreement was so that he could provide health insurance. He could stay married.
The reason why I ask is because it is part of the suggestion of the consideration that was given for this forbearance.
Well, also in the record, Your Honor, she received the marital house, the home, which was marital property. So when Mr. Astore was on the stand, he was asked about the different things. There's no pinpointing the 401k was given up for the staying married. In fact, she received the marital home, and she didn't have to. In other words, that was a 50-50. That should have been divided. He gave her the marital home. She waived right to the 401k, and there is nothing in the record to trace an exact consideration for this or that. All we know from the record and all the letters is that this 20-year issue was only because of health insurance. It was to make sure that she got health insurance. And Mr. Allen entered into that agreement only thinking that there would be a remedy for him if he got divorced, if he did. He did not believe that he would have to stay married for 20 years.
Which is the struggle that I'm having, and I appreciate your argument, but the struggle that I'm having is that I assume that your client is an intelligent man, and I'm assuming that he can read plain English, and I'm assuming that he had a very good counsel that was advising him as to what he was getting and what he was giving away. And if there's a provision in the contract itself that makes reference to forbearance for divorce, why is that ambiguous?
Well, it's not ambiguous, Your Honor. We believe it's just unenforceable, and we do believe against public policy, certainly in the Commonwealth, when there hasn't been a single case ever upholding such a provision. We upped in again, waiving your grounds is not the same as being forced to stay married against your will for 20 years. Your Honor, we're very concerned in terms of the public policy argument that this is going to open the door to a hybrid type marriage, that we're going to have situations where people are forced to be, that agree to these contracts 20 years, 15 years later, you cannot move on with your life. You cannot be in these solemn relationship that you want to be because you have signed a contract and you have to stay married to someone against your will. It goes against the very fiber.
I've got to ask you about that because I'm reading from your brief now, and this is the portion that may be outside the record, but you've raised it. So the final order of divorce was entered on October 15th. Because Mrs. Allen failed to file for a stay pending appeal, Mr. Allen was remarried on October 22nd, 7 days later.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The trial court had 21 days in which to reconsider any of this. It was still within the bosom of the trial court.
No motion for reconsideration had been filed and no stay had been filed, Your Honor, and he was
But they presumably had at least motion for reconsideration until the 26th of October. And he, well, let's see, yeah, the, no, the till early November.
He had 14 more days.
Well, Your Honor, there was certainly nothing at that point. Not, in other words, that's what the motion to stay is the purpose is to stop you from taking any action. So he certainly at that point believed that once the motion to stay deadline had stopped, it was not going to be.
And that expired on what day?
I don't have the exact date. It was prior to, it was a day that he was waiting for to see, was she going to appeal, was she going to stop him from getting married and appeal. And that day came and went, and he believed that he was free to do so. And when he did so, it was a legal marriage. He was, in fact, legally divorced. There was no order of stay in place, and he was allowed to do so. Your Honor, the concern in terms of public policy, if I just may, is that we're going to have this perverse, distorted version of marriage out there. Marriage contracts, a contract to get married has never been enforceable. There are countries around the world where people contract to get married. In other words, you're going to pay me money and I'm going to marry you, and there are all sorts of out there contracts. And not once in the history of this nation has anyone ever been forced to marry somebody when they've agreed to do some contract. It's just not the case. People propose, a ring is often exchanged, money is spent, people quit jobs, move across the country, arrangements are made, all sorts of sacrifices and consideration go into an agreement to get married, but a person always has the right to back out. And there may be damages, there may be money involved, there may be paying back for the caterer and the hall and getting back the ring and that sort of thing. But there's never been a case where the court has ever forced anyone to get married to somebody. And what we're asking for here is that he be forced to continue to be married to a stranger that he's not in love with, that he doesn't even know anymore, that he's now remarried to somebody else who's deeply in love with. And to me, that creates, again, this sort of hybrid, it's a farce and almost a fraud in our sense. It's a lie to the world to say, well, I'm married because I've signed a contract, but that's not a real marriage. And Your Honor, I would just,
Your time is up. I'll give you 30 seconds.
Okay. Right. The Cooley case, it's very clear to say that in the Commonwealth, that the marriage is promoted and separation is discouraged. Well, we believe that a ruling, as the economy is looking for, is will seek to discourage marriage. It's not allowing, if you sign a contract that says you're going to stay married to someone for 20 years, 10 years, from there, you meet an actual person that you want to marry, you can't do so. It is creating long-term separations in parties that you're legally bound and stopping you from marriage. So it flies in the face of the Commonwealth's interest to promote marriage and to discourage separation. By doing that very thing, Mr. Allen will not be able to marry the person he wants to and will be forced to be separated from this woman for 20 years. And that is directly in contradiction to the Cooley case, Your Honor. We would suggest that it's a very bad road to go down. If we're going to have these marriages out there that are based on a contract, not love, not the basis, not the foundation that marriage has been described as, but as purely a contractual matter, and that you're out there having to be associated with someone that you no longer want to be. We believe that that's why specific performance was not appropriate. The trial court took all the evidence into consideration and decided that given the plain language of the agreement, two provisions which clearly call for what should happen here, that an adequate remedy of law was provided for, and Mr. Allen is complying with that remedy.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I've given you an extra minute.
Thank you very much, John.
And I gave him 2 minutes and 48 seconds. So.
I will combine myself the time you gave me. This idea of an adequate remedy of law, I know it exists, but on the other hand, have Griffin versus Griffin, and all of the cases that come before Griffin that say equity enforces the performance of the contract specifically, by compelling the refractory party to fulfill his engagement according to its terms. That's this court's decision in 2014, quoting Lyle versus Tunsmore from 1894. For decades in this Commonwealth, parties are held to the terms of their agreements. So this idea that the court is allowed to substitute its judgment and substitute a policy that's just as good for the policy that she contracted for is firmly at odds with Griffin versus Griffin and its progeny. On a policy level, I understand what Mr. Sills is arguing. I'd probably be arguing the same thing. But on the other hand, you have power versus power, which says essentially, look, if divorce litigants know that they can repudiate with impunity valid property settlement agreements, the usefulness and validity of all such contracts will be lessened. And that's what he did. He rolled the dice that the trial court would feel bad for him and not force him to be married. And that is not good policy. That is not good policy when you have a clear agreement. And put yourself, again, on a policy level, in the shoes of the attorney who wrote that contract. What are we telling lawyers about? You know, we already hold them to a very high standard, and we already have all these cases that talk about, you know, you have to be clear in contracts. What was her lawyer supposed to write other than what he wrote in that agreement?
Well, I guess the answer to that question is write the agreement without that secondary clause, and they're talking about what's going to happen if the parties do divorce.
Well, why not write, upon divorce, the husband shall provide comparable health insurance coverage for the wife? If that was truly an out, not put that in the contract. How difficult is that? It's not. If they were contemplating that he could get divorced and buy her a comparable policy, why not write that? And why go through the trouble of calling it a postnuptial agreement? Why go through the recitals that it was in specific consideration of continuance of marriage? Why have a provision entitled continuation of marriage? Why do that? Why not just sign a settlement agreement that says if the husband divorces the wife, he shall ensure that he provides comparable health insurance coverage and covers any and all unreimbursed medical expenses she would have been entitled to under the Caterpillar policy. They could have written that. They didn't.
Well, the dependent clause of the sentence that we've talked about several times is rather general. If loss of insurance is due to husband's actions, and I know you argue that's trumped by his agreement to stay married, not to do anything for 20 years related to divorce. But that doesn't say, except for suing for divorce. Is it just we're supposed to assume, I mean, to read that in there, that based on earlier parts of the agreement?
I mean, the agreement, again, you go back to, it's all a special agreement. It's a consideration of remaining married. They have a continuation of marriage provision. How many more times do we need to say it in the document before it becomes a reality that husband shall not pursue a dissolution of the marriage for a period of 20 years or obtain any judicial order or decree that results in the wife's disqualification of health insurance covered by Caterpillar? I don't know what a drafting attorney is supposed to do to make it any more clear. That's my concern on a policy level, is if you say, well, it allows him an out, and that's all he's got, really. I mean, that's the whole basis of his argument, is to say, well, the contract's confusing, and I didn't really mean what I mean. The letters both said, I'm giving up my right to sue for divorce for a long period of time. I know exactly what I'm doing. He knew what he was doing. He changed his mind, and now he's trying to get out of it. That's what this comes down to.
All right. The matter's presented. We'll...